You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right, welcome into the latest edition of Hear That Podcast Growlin'. Paul Diener Jr. and Jay Morrison of The Athletic. Excited to be with you as this is the eye of the draft season hurricane, Jay. There's certain, you know, realizations and real, you know, look in the mirror moments that you have when you file a draft strategy piece with 1,200 words and two charts on kickers. You just kind of realize that this is where we're at, man. This is when they talk about the grind. This is it. This is in depth.
Yes, we go deep for you.
I gotta say, in a sick, twisted way, I sort of enjoyed it. Like, just be like, you know what? I'm going all in on this. I'm not gonna just. They're gonna go all in on it inside the stadium. They're going all in on the kicker breakdowns. You know, why can't we? We're here for you too.
I mean, the odds are a game or two are going to come down to whoever that kicker is this year, where it's doubtful that a final play is going to be decided by Jamar Chase or Penei Sewell.
Think about how much people have yelled and screamed about the Jake Elliott, Randy Bullock decision, which I will not relitigate. I'm not mentally in a good place to handle that right now. However, think about the angst over Randy Bullock and the angst over that decision and draft. Think about all that when you think about if it's useless to talk about this kicker situation. It's not, because the one note I will say, and we're gonna dive more into this on Thursday, is when I actually went back through all the 32 7-round mock drafts that our beat writers did, and nobody. Not a single person except for us selected a kicker. So it could be out there for the pickings for them. We shall see. We'll get to that on Thursday's episode. We're going to talk all about our three series pieces that are coming out this week. We have Specialists, which is out now. We will have Defensive Line, so Edge Rusher on Wednesday, and Interior Defensive Line on Thursday. We'll dive into all of those on Thursday's podcast. For today's podcast, we have two big-time guests, and we're going to kind of dedicate most of it to them. Dane Brugler, as he does every year, comes and joins us to talk about the Beast and through a Bengals perspective, and I kind of hit him up on a lot of very specific. It was kind of like a test. It was sort of like, okay, 5th round receiving running back, who could come in the wide zone. Go. And he would drop a couple names in for me. You know, we kind of hit a bunch of specific Bengals targets you expect to see later in the draft that he has for the epic launching of the Beast that is out now that you can get free with your Athletic subscription. And so we have that, and talking a lot about, of course, Chase versus Sewell, which brings in our other guest, which is Robert Mays, who hosts the Athletic NFL podcast and does a fantastic job with that and wrote a definitive piece on Chase versus Sewell this week. If you have not read it, it's a must read if you want to have an opinion on the hottest debate in Bengals Nation. So you can do that. And then I highly recommend listening to our conversation. We talk through all of Chase versus Sewell, and people must declare themselves, Jay. Which side are you on? Two declarations happen on this podcast from our guests, so it's good.
And it is. It's down to two. I've not seen too many hashtags Team Pitts. I know they exist, but I think they're a vocal minority. I wonder, I mean, did you think you were going to stump Dane? I can't imagine a harder person to stump than Dane on talking draft anything.
No, no. And you could sense as I, you know, we were doing it over Zoom on video chat, and I would be kind of getting into the, you know, very specifics of the type of player we're looking for. And he'd just kind of be nodding along with me. Yep. Yep. I already got you. I already know where I'm going with this. And certainly he would, and it would never just be one name. It would always be multiple. So we'll have those two conversations with you today on the podcast. Also want to remind everybody to subscribe if you're not already a subscriber. Trent has an incredible story out of just former teammates and rivals giving stories about Joey Votto that are just – the dude is just ridiculous. It's so good. Highly recommend that. Of course, Justin Williams on all the UC debacle that's going on. He's got everything covered there in our draft strategy series, still ongoing. You can click on any of those links, subscribe, and get all of that, plus the beast, plus all the draft. It's just ridiculous what's going on right now. The other thing that's up is our four-path mock draft. I want us to talk a little bit about that, but let's bring in Dane first. And get to that conversation, because listening to him talk about the Bengals draft is as good as it gets. We'll start there. When we come back, we'll break down some of our takeaways from the four-path mock draft and then get to Robert May. So here is my conversation with Dane Brugler. All right, as we love to do every year here, and I don't know that I need to go through the full introduction, because if you're an Athletic subscriber, you are well aware of the incredible work that Dane Brugler does. The Beast is out. It has been released. If you're listening to this as a subscriber, you have no doubt already poured through it a bunch, and will a lot for the next month. But Dane is here with us. Also, Prospects to Pros podcast Dane does with Lance Zierlein on The Athletic. Top 100, mock drafts, you name it. It's all out there, and we're happy to have Dane with us. Dane, what's going on, man?
Hey, Paul. Appreciate you having me on. It's been a crazy process with everything going on, but, you know, I'm glad that it's kind of worked out. You know, no combine, weren't sure how that was going to you know, make us adjust to this process, but so far so good. It's been interesting, but, you know, we're almost to the finish line. We got a few weeks left.
How hard was that, gathering all the numbers off the pro days? Was that an unenviable task?
Sure, no, and that's honestly maybe the thing I'm most proud of with this year's guide is, you know, we don't have any combine data, obviously. So there's over 600 players in there with official NFL verified pro day numbers in the draft guide. And so that's something I'm very proud of this year, just how important that is. And just to add some context, it's difficult when you talk about, because, you know, we're not talking about one central setting. We're talking about indoor, outdoor, you know, weather is a factor, the type of track, you know, different people, you know, taking these measurements and, you know, the stopwatches, things like that. But if it's official for the NFL, then that's good enough for me, because that means that's the numbers that the NFL is using. So I don't, you know, we can talk about margin of error all we want, but if that's what NFL teams are using, then, you know, that helps give us some type of context into, you know, just the testing data part of things when we talk about these players.
And so much, a lot, Bruce Feldman had a great piece on, you know, the elimination of the 40 and the GPS data, mm-hmm. going to be so huge going forward. How, you know, how do you look at that when you talk about the future of, you know, this for you as well as teams with the same lens there? I mean, how you will try to take that on going forward? And do you get a sense of what the league views of taking that on going forward?
It's coming. There's no question. I think the only thing we'll miss is just the nostalgic of, you know, talking about 40 times and, you know, all these different, you know, metrics. But when it comes down to it, we want to get these players right. And, you know, figuring out the best way to understand their athleticism and everything going on with, you know, body composition, things like that. The technology is there. So let's find the best and most resourceful ways to do that. And figuring out the GPS data on the field within a football context, I mean, that's something that is extremely valuable. And a lot of companies are working at as we speak, just in terms of getting down, okay, what works, what doesn't, what are NFL teams going to be interested in? So, you know, I think within the next, you know, 3 to 4 years, it is going to become, you know, the new normal, something that we're, you know, the combine doesn't need to go away. There's still plenty of, you know, usefulness there, but we're going to be relying on more and more unique ways to gather that information.
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt about it. Well, you're on the Bengals podcast. We recently did a on Monday on the site, we put out a four-way path mock draft for the Bengals, who have a maybe the most interesting decision in the first round, sitting there at number five, a real pivot point. Of course, Sewell versus Chase is tearing up the Bengals internet. and we threw Pitts and a trade back in there as four different ways they can go, because it's about more than one player. It's about what does your end group look like. We used the Beast and your top 100 as our guides to get us through that. And it creates a lot of different paths. I'll just, since you're here, you have to declare yourself. where do you stand on Sewell versus Chase, or I'll even throw in versus Pitts in there for you.
Yeah, I read that article this morning. It was really interesting that you and Jay put together. And we're actually working on a 7-round mock that's going to go up this week. So, you know, all 259 picks, trying to really work through that in terms of, you know, trends with teams, you know, who have they met with, you know, obviously team needs, all of that. So trying to make it as realistic as possible. And the Bengals, in a lot of ways, it feels like that's kind of where the draft starts. You know, we know quarterbacks are going 1, 2, 3. We think there's a good chance quarterback goes 4. And then what happens at 5? You know, are they going to get that trade offer that's going to be too enticing to pass up? You know, how do they feel about, you know, Pitts and Chase and Sewell? And, you know, do they allow maybe the depth at one of those positions to affect what decision they make at 5? Personally, I'm in the camp of, I'm not going to let what could happen later, second, third round, dictate what I'm going to do in the first round. I'm taking the best player. That's that. But there are several teams that look at it and say, well, you know, tackle kind of stretches, or wide receiver, I like the depth in the third round. So, you know what, we're going to go this position here. So that is a factor that some teams subscribe to. You know, and so when it comes down to it, though, I'm going offensive line here. I'm taking Penei Sewell now, which is, it's tough because I actually have Pitts and Chase rated higher on my top 100 board. But, you know, we're talking about guys that are pretty closely ranked. But I the idea of keeping Joe Burrow on his feet and keeping him healthy is too appealing to pass up to me. And I know, you know, they've got the tackles kind of worked out for the short term, but we're talking about a guy that's 20 years old in Penei Sewell, who is still learning, which is scary because he's so good right now. But the fact that you project him to get better and better is really an appealing part. So I would lean the tackle, but I mean, this is like a good problem to have. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're the Bengals, it's, I don't know that you necessarily go wrong, because even if you're a fan that's hoping for, you know, a different player than who they take, all you have to do is focus on who they drafted and you're going to get over it pretty quick.
What are the concerns with Penei Sewell? I mean, we talk about, you know, people watch some of the tape and then we're going to have this arm length discussion. But I mean, for you, what are the concerns, if there are any, for where he stands as, you know, tackle one potentially?
He's not a perfect prospect. Let's get that out there now. And a fascinating exercise is to put him in last year's offensive tackle class, which we know was so top heavy. Where would he rank? And for me, he probably would have come out at number 4, the number 4 tackle. Jedrick Wills was my top guy last year. I would have him higher than Sewell. Tristan Wirfs was close behind Wills, and I would have him above Sewell. And then Becton, I think I would have him barely over Sewell, and then Sewell would come in right behind Becton. So, and that just because Sewell was the 4th tackle last year, that's nothing to you know, because when you factor, you just look at last year's tackles, it was such a strong group. But you know, he's not a perfect player. He's still young. You know, there are times where the timing is a little bit off, especially at the second level. He can get better with his body angles. But mostly it's stuff that's coachable. It's things that you look at and you say, okay, you know, he just needs some more reps, especially a player who opted out this past year. You know, we don't have that 2020 film. And so there's a year of development that we could be missing. I don't think he needed to take another snap for you to understand what kind of talent he was. Same thing with Jamar Chase, another opt-out. But, you know, I want to know, okay, you know, what have you been doing the last year to get better at football? You know, I know you've been working out. I know you've put in the time. But in terms of developing your on-field abilities, what have you been working on? Who have you been working with? Specifically, you know, what has been, you know, from set points to your hands, what have you been doing? And so all these things factor in with Sewell. And so there's definitely some areas where you want to see him mature and get better. But when you focus on it, one of the big reasons I loved Tristan Wirfs last year was the big man balance, just very, very rare. And that's what you see with Sewell, that big man balance. You don't see him on the ground. The flexibility, the mobility, the natural football instincts. It's 330 pounds. And you see, you just look at him, he looks like he's 285, 290. And it's I don't know where it goes. He just has, you know, just that Samoan body, the way he's built, it's just so unique. And that 330 pounds is just packed on really well. And, you know, just see him out there moving like he does is really impressive, but also the mental aspect of this. He is so quick. He makes those split second reads and he makes them so easily. Natural instincts, you know, the coaches that at Oregon just rave about him mentally. So, you know, all these strong selling points are, you know, go into the reasoning why I would take Sewell at number five.
All right, let's take a second and switch gears here and hear from a sponsor.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
So much of this discussion, like you said, ends up getting into the, okay, well, what can you get in the second and third round? Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that on the offensive line and include guard in that discussion. Cause with the Riley Reiff signing, they obviously do have the flexibility to maybe even take a guard there and be comfortable. In fact, Sewell most likely is going to play guard when he shows up for year one. What does that look like for you? I mean, and how deep is it? Is that a misnomer that maybe there isn't as much there? And how much does that matter when you really analyze that second, third round, you know, offensive line class?
If we're going to list the positions this year in the draft in terms of strongest to weakest, you know, I think we have to start a quarterback just because it's rare that we're going to have five quarterbacks likely off the board in the top, you know, seven and nine. And after that, I think you talk about wide receiver and offensive tackle as the next two in whichever order you want. So offensive tackle is definitely one of the stronger positions this year. Usually normal years, it's hard to find those tackles in round two. You know, it doesn't happen very often. But this year feels like the exception. And there's a reason we're talking about these guys as second rounders, not first rounders. So that, you know, that's a factor. But there's plenty of things that Sam Cosmi, you look at Liam Eichenberg, Alex Leatherwood, if you see him as a tackle. I personally like him best at guard, but some teams grade him as the tackle. You know, you look at Walker Little from Stanford or Brady Christensen, BYU. These guys are all really talented. There might be just one thing about them that you worry about. You know, with Liam Eichenberg, the lack of length, the fact that he had too many penalties in college, he had a smaller margin for error. So if he makes a mistake, it's usually costly. So with Liam Eichenberg, he's a good player, but there are some of those, you know, you can poke holes in him. Sam Cosmi, same type of thing, where doesn't have great length. You know, he's a little light with his anchor, and when he uses his body posture really well, he can stop bullies and, you know, anchor down and create that base strength. But if his posture is not on time and on schedule, then he can get pushed back a little bit. So, you know, with each one of these players into the second round range, they could absolutely end up being long-term NFL starters, but there's a little less margin for error with these guys, which creates some doubt. So I think this is going to be one of those exception years where tackle usually not strong into the second, third round. Usually those guys go in the first. I think this year will be that exception.
Yeah. What, from the receiver perspective, you know, we keep talking about these deep classes and there's so many receivers out there. that, and we see so many succeed in the second, third, fourth round. If we're talking from a Bengals perspective, they're looking for explosion. They're looking for deep ball. They're looking to loosen the teams up that are just pushing up on them with safeties and coverage, and they don't feel like they have that element. Let's say that they don't take Ja'Marr Chase, who obviously would bring you a lot of that element. In the second and third round, deep ball, who are we talking about there? And or are there enough guys there to be comfortable?
I think so. If you're looking for that deep ball threat, De'Ami Brown is one of my favorites this year. We talk about just being a vertical deep threat. He is the most skilled double move receiver in this draft, because that takes more than just being fast. That there is some skill involved. With just that slight hesitation, the little body movements, the ability to get the corner off balance, that it really is a skill, and Brown's very, very good at it. And he's also fast. That is a part of it. He's a legit low 4.4 type of guy. He needs to eliminate some of the easy drops, but he tracks the ball really well downfield. Plenty of times he had to slow down because he's down the field before the quarterback could get him the ball. But he understands how to track the ball over his shoulder. He does simple, these little subtle things to shield defenders from the football downfield. So I'm a big fan of his game. I think that, anywhere on day two is not too early for De'Ami Brown. So that would make some sense. We've seen guys like Terrace Marshall from LSU. He has a downfield element to his game because he's a glider. He gets going and you don't necessarily see a track athlete. Part of that is because he's so big. He's 6'2" and a half, 205 pounds. But next thing you know, he's downfield behind the defense. And, those strides are so long and he glides. So and that showed in his 40 time with a 4.40. So I think Terrace Marshall could also be included in that group. Then you guys, even in the third and fourth rounds, you have, if you want to get a 2-2 Atwell, who's tiny, but he's this year's version of a Hollywood Brown, who's just, you're going to have some drops. You're going to have a small target, but he can absolutely fly. And for, an offense that is specifically looking for that type of threat, somewhere in the third round makes sense.
Let's quickly jump in and best third down change of pace running back. We're looking for the next Giovanni Bernard on day three. Guy who can receive the ball out of the backfield. You're comfortable in these passing situations. You obviously have Mixon. Who's that guy?
Yeah, and this is running back is not a super loaded position this year. You've got the guys at the top with Najee Harris, Travis Etienne, Javonte Williams, guys that could all be top 40 picks, probably will be. But then after that, I think there's a little bit of a drop off, and you're getting into more specialized roles for how you plan to use the running back position. Kenneth Gainwell, I don't know that you're going to give him 12 plus carries per game, but he's so good as a receiver and as a pass catcher that he becomes a really intriguing option if you plan on implementing him in the right way. If you want to line him up out wide, he can do that. He can run routes just fine. He can catch the ball away from his body. You want to keep him in the backfield, he can do that too. I just don't know that you're necessarily going to give him the ball carries that many times. But if you, again, want to use him as a receiver, he can do that. Michael Carter from North Carolina is one of my favorites this year. He's so quick. He's a problem-solving back. He sees a problem and he finds a way out of it, usually by being able to juke and sidestep and that initial quickness. Having all this NFL verified pro day data, went through in the short shuttle, only two players in this draft out of 600 had under a 4 second, 4.00 short shuttle. And that was Ja'Marr Chase and Michael Carter. So both these guys have that short area quickness that's really just special. And for Michael Carter, that helps him make guys miss. He's only 200 pounds. And so I give him a lot of credit. He is tough as nails in pass protection. I mean, he will stand guys up, but he doesn't have that anchor where he's going to be able to hold up necessarily and sustain as a blocker. The pass catcher, he's really productive as well. So Michael Carter, he's probably in that early fourth round range. Maybe he sneaks into the top 100 on the day two, but there's a chance he could still be there early day three. I think he would make a ton of sense as well.
All right, last one. Another replacement looking for an edge. Rotational path. Think Carl Lawson when he was drafted. Rotational pass rusher to come in and play behind Trey Hendrickson and Sam Hubbard. We'll give you even day two. Where does that? I mean, it's a deep class there this year.
It is. It's a weird class because we're used to having that top guy. You know, a Chase Young, the Bosas, Myles Garrett. We don't have that this year. I would be very surprised if we had a pass rusher drafted top 10, but it's still a pretty decent group because there's a lot of guys in that, 20 to, 80 range, guys that are flawed, but talented, and guys that'll be available on day two that the Bengals could be looking at. You look at Carlos Basham from Wake Forest, who, is a little straight line-ish with how he moves, but he does not quit. Love the motor. There's a little bit of Rashawn Gary there with how he plays. He's really productive at Wake Forest. So there's a lot to like about his resume and just his football character and what he brings to the field. If a Peyton Turner from Houston makes some sense as well. He's a really long player who's 6'5", 270, 35 inch arms. He's really kind of blossoming at the right time. He got better and better throughout college at Houston. Little high cut, but the motor does not quit on him. So I think he has a chance to be, I don't know that he's going to be around for the Bengals in the third round. I think there's a good chance he's off the board somewhere in the top 50, 55 picks. Ronnie Perkins, Oklahoma, he could be maybe that guy in the early third round range, 6'2 and a half, 255 pounds. He can win with quickness. He can win with power. You feel like he's getting better as he continues to learn how to use his hands. He's a very physical player. So, and even though he does have a suspension on his resume, the coaches at Oklahoma still speak highly of him. And the Bengals, I don't know that they really care about this suspension anyway. So he's a guy that as he continues to add to his bag of tricks, we're going to see him get better and better. So Perkins could be in that Lawson mold where, not drafted first two rounds, but, he could end up proving to be a steal wherever he ends up being drafted.
I'll give you one chance to show off before we let you go. Favorite sleeper. You had a top 10 of your favorite sleepers, although some of them guys are not becoming sleepers anymore, it seems like. Who is the guy that you love in the back of this draft that you're standing up for right now?
I've been talking about Jacob Harris a lot, the wide receiver tight end from UCF who just, my favorite part about this process is learning about these guys' backstories and, their backgrounds, all the different steps that it took to get to this point, the NFL doorstep, because no two are the same. They come from different backgrounds, different journeys. For Jacob Harris, he was a soccer player his entire life, grew up wanting to play in the MLS. His senior year of high school, he got coaxed onto the football field just have some fun. And he does. He does. And then he goes to Florida Gulf Coast on a soccer scholarship. And after about a week, he was, that itch that he got playing football, he wanted to go back to it. So walks on at Western Kentucky, got homesick, goes back home, walks on UCF, and gradually got better and better. And this past year as a senior, 8 touchdowns, and he killed his pro day. I'm glad I came out with that sleeper article before his pro day, because then it really started to blow up. But yeah, 6'5", 220 pounds. He's a 4.40 athlete, 6'5", 1.3 cone, just silly numbers. And so he's also a guy that's going to help me on special teams. He was a big time special teamer for UCF, 10 tackles. So I'm going to draft him somewhere on day 3 and feel good about him. Help out on special teams while I continue to develop him as a wide receiver or tight end, that big slot pass catcher. And I think he could end up outplaying wherever he ends up being drafted.
Well, the backstories and the information, all of it is out of this world. Another incredible year of it, Dane. So congratulations on getting that thing out, because it is it's incredible. And if anybody listening does not have it, or you can just go to the site, and the beast is easy to find. Click on it, and if you're a subscriber, you get it as part of your subscription. That alone makes a subscription well worth it. So congratulations on everything, Dane.
I appreciate it, Paul.
All right. Always great to hear from Dane. And I hope people enjoyed that. Excellent insight into what you can look for and expect. in this draft. You know, a lot of kind of what we were talking about there with Dane was how these different things can play out depending on what happens early. And so we took it on ourselves. Not, you can't just do one mock draft anymore, Jay.
No.
One mock is not good enough at this point.
One per week is not good enough.
Not one, not two, not three, four paths for our latest 7-round mock drafts that we put together. They were based on what would happen at the first pick and how that would change what happens the rest of the way out. They were broken down into Team Sewell, Team Chase, Team Pitts, and Team Trade. We each took two. We went through it. We kind of tried to keep a lot of the back end picks that were hitting the same boxes the same so you could see where the real differences occur. I thought it was telling. Jay, what was your kind of biggest takeaway in looking at it and going through it?
That the Bengals are taking Patrick Jones in the 4th round. I think that was the pick in 3 of the 4. Other than the trade back, that was the pick both of us were in agreement on. The other one was if they do go Jamar Chase in the 1st round, we talk about how deep this tackle class is. Not top heavy, but deep. But really, you know, the parameters we laid out were that you could pick anyone within 5 picks of Dane Brugler's top 100. And Alex Leatherwood fit that barely. Dane has him 33. And the Bengals are picking 38. But in most of the mocks, when I ran simulators on PFF, he wasn't there. And if he's not there, it almost feels like the other guys that weren't there either that you would think the Bengals could use at tackle, they almost have to trade back out of that 2nd round, or they're really reaching for a guy, or then they're really rolling the dice and going after a tackle of the future in the 3rd round. It's not as simple as Chase versus Sewell in that 1st round and get the other position later, because they could really be in a perilous spot if they don't take Sewell and Leatherwood's gone and then they have to reach at 38.
And maybe, but here's the thing, and I think a really interesting thing that Dane talked about was, you know, the idea of this being, you know, normally you're not thinking you're going to get a starter, and the questioning of can you get a starter at that 38th pick when you're talking about offensive tackles, and in most years that is not the case. But that this does feel like an outlier year, and that you can't, and another thing that is so prevalent right now in conversations within the league are how different everybody is once you get past Sewell and Slater and Vera Tucker. You end up in this mix of somebody has this guy 3rd, somebody has this guy 10th, somebody has this guy all over the map. And I think what you'll end up with, maybe we're wrong, there's just a lot of names that I think you could see being surprised that are there. I'll go back to a couple years ago, Cody Ford. Remember, Cody Ford was like, oh man, everybody assumed he was going to go maybe top 15. And there he was, like, you know, 4 or 5 picks into the 2nd round. I think you can see that, especially when you consider how many guys there are. I mean, when you start getting into names, like, where's Tevin Jenkins going to go? And I'm not saying he's going to be there when the Bengals pick, but, you know, Dane has a 1st/2nd on him. You know, you got Samuel Cosmi, Liam Eichenberg, Walker Little, Brady Christensen. I mean, all of these guys are guys slated to go around where the Bengals would be picking. And yes, they could do their patented 2nd round drop back. And I think you saw some of the benefits of that when you look at the trade path. I mean, the trade path, if you can pull it off, is the way to go. It's just a matter of actually being able to pull it off. Checking so many boxes in such a good way, we ended up, I believe, with 5 picks in the top 100. Okay, I mean, and got Rashawn Slater. And I think that's very much in play if you're moved back to 9. And And I think you could get Sewell there potentially. One of those two very easily could be there at nine, or you could take another lineman and Tucker, or you could go any other direction. But you checking off that many boxes is great. But I don't know if it is leather, like, you know, like you got to get Leatherwood, because you're talking about a number of these guys that there's no saying that they're for sure going to go in the first round. And a lot of these guys, you know, they're going to have a high grade on somebody higher than most. That is, has maybe a second round grade on, just because there's so many and there's so many varied opinions. And that's not even getting into some of the potential, you know, with guard, just picking guy who's more slated to be just a guard, whether, you know, with where's Landon Dickerson going to go? How do they feel about Jalen Mayfield? There's a number of names in there, I think, that would be in the mix that could hit them.
Yeah, I was just thinking more of the tackle range and going by Dane's rankings, where all those other guys you mentioned, he has them going higher, and they did go higher in the simulators. But you're right. Every year a guy falls, and it's not like an Alex Leatherwood or bust kind of thing, but that's just the way it played out with the parameters we put in place. And then, you know, we'll get to this later with your conversation with Robert Mays, but, you know, he brought up a great point where, what is your focus? Is your focus 2021, or is your focus the next 4 or 5 years? I think if you ask the coaches, it's 2021, because that's all they're promised right now. That may be why Chase is more to their liking, whereas the front office might be looking at building this thing, or should be looking at this thing, building this thing long term, and maybe Sewell fits better in when you're going at it from that perspective.
Yeah, we'll get to Robert Mays here in a second. I thought that part of the conversation was really a great piece of who's going to have the final say here, and is it about this year or is it about the long run? Because I think that's a big part of this conversation as well. As far as, I did want to just touch on a couple of pieces of news before we get into Robert. The Bengals signed Thad Moss, a guy who we had them maybe even taking him at the end of that draft, certainly eyeballing him as a priority free agent. He didn't end up coming here. Well, Washington waives him and the Bengals picked him up off waivers, so he'll come here. I know when we talked to Brody Miller, our LSU writer last year, he talked about Thad Moss being one of Joe Burrow's best friends. He's been here working out with him a little bit even. So, in the back of that room being pretty empty, this is no surprise and really an easy, snug fit to have him come. I mean, this isn't going to be a game changer. I mean, this is a guy that's already bounced around a couple of teams. But the Burrow connection, certainly something you can try out.
And the pedigree obviously comes into play there. And I remember at the Combine in 2020, there was a kind of a gap between players and positions where we thought the Bengals were going to be interested. And Jeff Hobson and I both sat in on Thaddeus Moss's media session there. And the words that we used after that was over was man crush. I mean, he was just, we talk about scribe wins. That's what this guy, the eye contact, the listening to the actual question and responding. And he just seemed like a great locker room. Now, obviously his dad's been in the media for a long time now, and he's done interviews for a long time. So it kind of goes as expected that he would be kind of polished, but he was just so impressive to listen to. And this is the ultimate low risk, high reward pick. He may never catch a pass from Joe Burrow, but you've got to at least take a shot. If they have that connection on the field and as friends, and it's a spot on the team that is thin right now, just made all the sense in the world. A guy's coming off, he's had surgery on both feet. That's always a concern for a receiver, but you know, the guys come back from that kind of stuff. And they found this latest foot issue last year at the combine. He never played a down. He was on IR the entire year for Washington, and they just let him go a couple of days ago, and no surprise, the Bengals snatched him up on waivers.
The other bit of news, Giovanni Bernard lands in Tampa Bay. Not a bad spot, nope. Right? How about the defending champs that are running it back for a guy who hasn't seen the playoffs in 5 years or had a playoff win in his career, you know, can hope to be He'd be in there with playoff Lombardi Lenny, I guess he is now, Ronald Jones, and then Gio will be, you know, in some version of a third down back. You know, the instant connection I went back to was James White, who we know is one of his best friends, the best man of his wedding, and was the right-hand man for Tom Brady out of the backfield for almost for the entirety of White's career until last year. And Brady certainly utilized him. You could argue he should have been, James White could have been the MVP of the Super Bowl, the 28-3 comeback Super Bowl, where he caught about 14 balls and had a couple of touchdowns, including the game winner. Probably a pretty glowing review of Giovanni Bernard, I imagine, was made in a call there. And apparently Brady and Bruce Arians were lobbying Gio while he reportedly had interest also from San Francisco and Seattle. Also, not too far from Miami. Can he convince his dad to leave the laundry shop for a day to drive to Tampa and back? Can he convince him?
Yeah, was that like 7 or 8 hours? That's not too bad.
It's a decent haul. Maybe a quick flight. I don't know. We'll see if it's close enough. I look forward to finding out if it's close enough. But so that's where Gio ends up landing. Good spot for him and good for him. Good, you know, not surprised there was interest in people picking up his skill set. So good for him. Let's go ahead and get to the conversation with Robert Mays. He has to declare himself. Which side is he on? I don't know. Is he going to be introducing himself to Ja'Marr Chase? Perhaps we should remind him what that sounds like.
How you doing?
Could he say or it, but he might be on a different team. We shall see. All right. Here's my conversation with Robert Mays as we go all in on Chase versus Sewell. All right. Now I want to welcome in Robert Mays, who at this point, I hope everyone, if you're listening to this and you're on the Bengals podcast, you probably are well aware of had this conversation, or should I call it a conversation, or have you yelled at somebody who also is a Bengals fan about this? We've reached the point where it's only straight like internet vitriol between the Bengals Civil War sides that this has turned into. But an incredible piece that Robert wrote about what Penny Sewell versus Ja'Marr Chase debate tells us about how teams value positions. The Bengals have become, I'm really happy about this from someone who creates content, a fascinating flashpoint in the draft. And it's really fun to discuss and talk through because there's just a number of different nuances to this. But I wanted to make sure Robert and I wanted to chat about it. You can also go back. He has the Athletic NFL podcast. They had a conversation last week, him and Nate Tice, where they kind of dove into this topic there as well. But this is a good chance for us to flesh it out after this piece was out. Great piece, first of all, Robert, and good to have you on.
Thank you. I'm happy to do it. This is a conversation I've had several times in several different places, and I have not tired of it yet. I think it's so, so interesting.
Well, I'm glad you haven't tired of it. You should try being on the Bengals podcast.
I came to it like a month later than you did, which I feel like that's why. Give me 4 more weeks. By the time draft day rolls around, I will be done talking about this, and I don't have to do it every single day.
The good news is I think that all Bengals fans will arrive at this part whenever the name is actually uttered at the end of this month, where their feelings are so numb either way that they just have already accepted to just let it go. I really think the fire is already going to be out by that point. Let's hope that people can just, because I think the point that we should say before we even start here is that it'll probably be fine either way. It's hard to screw up number 5 in a lot of ways. I mean, you can, but for the most part, if you're right, if you're saying the name Ja'Marr Chase or you're saying the name Penei Sewell, there's a lot to like about what you just added to your team, period, full stop.
Yeah, and the piece that I wrote, I think you can frame it as definitively pro Sewell. I'm like hashtag team Sewell as this has started to unfold. But I explicitly wanted to say after I wrote it that I understand both arguments. I understand wanting to go either way. For me, it's more just about the ways that we've found players at these positions. And I think that there are layers to the argument beyond what I explored in the piece that I wrote. You know, I thought the way I laid it out was that it's easier to find quality starters at wide receiver than it is at offensive tackle. And that's just how it's been over the last several years. You just look at where those players come from and how often they are typically available, whether that's in the draft, free agency, everything. But I think there's an argument about where do you want to be the most high quality? Where is it better to be elite or average? There are layers of that I didn't necessarily explore because I think that that conversation is murky. The guy PFF has done a lot of research on positional value overall. They'll tell you the receivers are much more valuable than tackles. It's more important to be elite at receiver. I feel like we have to do a lot of interrogating of those points, and there's a lot deeper that we can go. But again, there's so many different aspects of this that I think you could dig into and spin your own way depending on which side you want it to fall on.
There is a significant advantage, and we've talked endlessly about this here, from a Bengals perspective, of going from disaster up front to average. And if they can do that, then you can let Joe cook, so to speak. That is what you need. You need to not have the disastrous issues that cause him to use his, pocket presence superpower every single time he drops back and take that many hits. And you do that with depth as much as you do with high end, and the idea of being able to check that box, because we've talked a lot about, okay, you draft the offensive lineman. Even if you put him in at guard, you make your five better immediately, and you can work your way to serviceability instantly and have depth at tackle in case something goes wrong, which it always seems to do around here. So it's like that is just such an important aspect of this offseason, and I think that's where a lot of the value comes. Now, is it also very fun to talk about Ja'Marr Chase and the idea of having Chase, Boyd, Higgins, Mixon, Burrow all playing together for the next 3 years? Like, yeah, that's really fun. But, problem one on this team is figuring out a way to fix the offensive line. And the question to me, Robert, comes back to the evaluation. He is not a perfect prospect, Penei Sewell. And that's part of it, is like, are you definitely hitting? Like, if he was definitely like, this guy is definitely going to be great, then I think you feel more comfort in just taking him and not worrying about anything else. But because it's not, this is not surefire, there are questions surrounding him, makes it much more interesting.
I think so too. Yeah, he's not a perfect prospect. And I've joked about the arm length stuff, and I think it's kind of silly. If the guy can play, he can play. But if you're talking about where he fits among the best offensive tackle prospects, that stuff matters. Like, if you want to check every single box, he doesn't check every single box. You didn't see him do a lot of traditional drop back pass setting at Oregon. I mean, I feel like he projects to be a really good player, but I don't think he's a ready-made walk into the Hall of Fame type of guy in the way that somebody like Joe Thomas was. And that should matter here. I also think a huge part of this, and it's something I didn't get into as much in the piece that I wrote because it was already like 3,000 words long, but I think you have to think about what's more important. Is the 2021 season the most important thing here, or are we building over the course of some 4 or 5 year stretch? If the 2021 season and the roster, the way it looks in 2021, is all we're talking about, I can understand wanting to go receiver there because you already have two, let's say, capable starters at offensive tackle. But I wouldn't do it that way. I wouldn't think we're building for 2021 and trying to fit these holes and these needs for a team that I truly believe is much more than one offensive lineman, one wide receiver away from being a true contender.
All right, let's just take a quick break. Now, you are not 6-25-1 entering your third year as head coach, though, Robert Mays, as Zach Taylor is. So if his voice in the room matters, he is on the hot seat, and it is about 2021 for him, and you wonder how much his urgency will matter up against the voices of those in the front office, up against Duke Tobin and the family, because they're thinking more long term because they're not going anywhere. But Zach Taylor knows he sure as hell could be if this season goes south, and that makes it really interesting. The interesting thing is, and I think an element from a Bengals perspective is, and I wrote this with my thought that I think they're going to take Chase. I wouldn't, because the way they have struggled drafting offensive linemen here has been the problem. I mean, it's just over and over again, it has caused an issue. Jonah Williams is fine. Like, and that was the most prominent pick that they've had recently. He's also not proven. I mean, he's certainly not been incredible at number 11 overall. The injury, we have a small sample size, all that, but he is kind of who he is. But you go down the line, when having to parse through guys with different weaknesses that aren't, they have badly failed. And how much confidence you have, how much ability do you have to self-scout yourself organizationally and say, hey, we have not been great at this. So perhaps we should take the best chance to make sure we get that right, because we have been really good at drafting receivers and defensive linemen later in the draft. And I wonder how much that understanding who you are and what you have been organizationally plays into it, if you have that awareness as an organization, and how many would.
And also, I feel like there's been a lot of bouncing around between who the offensive line coach has been, right? I mean, it's, there was one guy in I think Frank Polk was there for 1 year, then he's gone for 2 years, and now he's back. And you know, that part of it, I think, is definitely plays into it. And having continuity at those spots and having a truly great offensive line coach that goes so far, I think, maybe more than any other position when it comes to developing those guys. I mean, the Patriots, you almost have to throw them out when it comes to understanding positional stacking and value within the draft. Like, they can go get Michael and Wenyu. I know Skarnecchia wasn't there last year, but for the most part, they've been able to find guys at all of these spots in the draft, at even a premium position like tackle, because they've developed them so well. So that's part of it. Can you develop those guys after you draft them, even at high points? And the Bengals have not shown an ability to do that.
No, and you know, the Cedric Obwehi, Jake Fisher first and second round draft essentially got Paul Alexander fired, who had been around forever and developed Hall of Famers, should be Hall of Famers, Andrew Whitworth, Willie Anderson, guys like that in his career. But you know, something like that happens and everybody sours on you, and that's how fastly it changes. The interesting thing with receivers, though, and, you know, you talk about this and mention it, I just want to kind of briefly run through some names just so people have these names in front of them. You search first-round receivers versus second-round receivers in the last – from 2016 to 19. So throwing out last year, giving some time for development, you can just look at that sample size. The names – if I gave you these lists and put them aside, you would take the second-round list over and over and over again. I by the way, the Pro Bowl is the worst, the biggest sham ever, but I'm just going to use it because with receiver, at least there's easier numbers that people tend to get it a little more right. No Pro Bowlers from 2016, 2019. Again, I want to reiterate, I hate the Pro Bowl, but I'm just saying this for reference here.
It's an easy thing to,
easy thing to grab, particularly with receiver. Yeah. And then 19 players selected in the second round as receivers from 16 to 19. And you are talking about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them, including Michael Thomas, Juju Smith-Schuster, A.J. Brown, D.K. Metcalf, Cortland Sutton. I mean, you go to go through the first rounders, you're talking about D.J. Moore, Corey Davis, Calvin Ridley, Will Fuller. That's the top of your list. Then you get into, you know, the Hollywood Browns, Josh Dotsons, Corey Coleman's of the world. And the point is this – and it's not just the second round. You could do this with other rounds in some ways too. They just when they do come from everywhere, and Ja'Marr Chase is not AJ Green, you know, or Julio Jones, you know, you have to realize that the difference between first and second, not only by your evaluation is it probably not that different, but historically it's just not.
And I also think that, though, there are examples of tackles that missed, obviously, in the first round, right?
Yeah.
But still, if you're looking at it, the vast majority of elite offensive tackles come from the first round. You have a couple examples of guys that came later than that that become top flight guys. Teron Armstead is one of them. Teron Armstead was drafted in the third round from Arkansas Pine Bluff. If you look at his physical profile, the two guys he is most similar to, I want to say, on a site like Mock Draftable, are Trent Williams and one other guy that was drafted in the top five. I can't remember who it is. It might be Lane Johnson. So he had the physical skills of a tackle often drafted in the top five, but the circumstances were very strange. David Bakhtiari is the other. He was drafted in the fourth round. He was 299 at the combine. He weighed less than 300 pounds at 6'4". And I've talked to David about this, and he was not big enough to hold up the way he wanted to at the NFL level as a rookie when he was forced into action. He wasn't even going to play that year. The only reason he had to is because they had injuries and Bulaga ended up getting hurt when they were flipping him to the left side. So those are two unique circumstances. For the most part, even if there have been misses, the best offensive tackles in the league consistently come from the first round. That's not true at receiver. It's just such a deeper pool. So while the misses, there's still more misses at receiver, even if the misses are comparable, the depth at receiver still allows you to find high quality players later in the draft. You talked about second round picks being some of the best receivers in the league. Devontae Adams is neat. You didn't even mention him. He was drafted, and that was a couple years earlier. It was 2014. I mean, he was the best receiver in the NFL last year. He was drafted in the 50s. That just doesn't happen with tackles. You can find starters drafted a little bit later on. I think guys like Deion Dawkins and Donovan Smith from Tampa are perfect examples of guys that became quality starters that you can just lock down one of those spots with a guy in the second round. But if you want high-end play, you typically have to find it in the first. That brings us back to the question of, do you need high-end offensive line play? Every single answer here begets another question. I think that's why it's so interesting.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I find, you know, the one thing in talking with Dane Brugler about this was him saying, you know, normally that is the case where you look in the second, third round, and you're just not finding. He's like, this is an outlier year. I do think this is an outlier year in that where this is a year where you're looking at, when you're talking about these guys, these are guys that do have flaws, but not to the point that you don't see them as solid starters and maybe better. You know, around here, there's always a look through some of the flashpoints of history, and Andrew Whitworth was a second-round pick who came in because they weren't sure. He had guard, tackle, tweener written all over him, and they were more than willing to accept that because they loved the guy, and he came in and looked. I mean, it's unbelievable he's still playing. And it hopefully will go into the Hall of Fame one day because he's deserving. But, you know, you're talking about – Those are the type of replications that they would be trying to do, and I just don't know how realistic that is to think that you're going to go draft Andrew Whitworth again in the second round. It's a really hard thing to do. Now for where they're at, maybe you just say we are kind of just drafting a guard, and if he becomes a tackle of the future, then that's great. But if he's a really good, you know, you can get a really good guard in the second round, which is true, then that's great. Then they feel like they have success and they're moving themselves forward. But there's a lot of trade off. When I like it, you did was looking at the scarcity of it through free agency. Like, look at how hard it is to find offensive linemen and what they get paid versus what happens with the receiver market. I mean, that really tells you value to me. The way you always follow the money is how you put it there is look at the scarcity of what happens in free agency. That tells you what the real value really is at these positions.
Here's what I would encourage Bengals fans to do, because I think it's so easy to say, all right, we'll draft Chase, and then there's so much depth that, especially interior offensive line in the second round, let's go draft a guard because that's the biggest position of need that we have. Let's move forward a year. Okay. Let's say 32-year-old Riley Reiff, who's my age, and I don't feel good about my own body, and I haven't spent a decade playing in the NFL. Let's say he's not great and is on a one-year deal, and at the end of next season, they don't feel like they want to bring him back. You drafted a guard in the second round. The guard is fine. He's an upgrade over Quentin Spain. He's a plug-and-play starter, the sort of which you find in the second round. If Reef, who's on a one-year deal, doesn't work out, we're playing the same game again next March where they don't have another starting tackle. And if they don't, do you want to look in free agency to find one? The answer is probably not. Taylor Moton is the guy that you would assume is a long-term starter among the 2022 free agents. I would have to assume he gets brought back in Carolina if he plays well this season. Other guys that are going to hit free agency next year at that spot, Dwayne Brown is 37. Teron Armstead is 31. That's what you get at tackle in free agency for the most part. These guys are near the end of their careers, or they would have been retained by the teams that they're playing for. Like next year, there's a chance. Let's say you draft Sewell at 4. Let's say you piece together that number 3 wide receiver spot. Tate has some role, is doing what he does well. He's big. You know, obviously, the top line speed isn't there. You try to find some sort of speed element in the fifth or like later in this draft, which I assume there's a lot of smaller guys who can give you that based on what I understand. And next year, Will Fuller is a free agent. Guys like that. I mean, that's the thing to me. I would look at it over a multi-year period of what's going to happen as you're trying to build this thing, not which holes can we fill immediately right now.
I think you're right. And it's so easy if you really want one to go get a receiver at a reasonable price. But if you really want one, you're paying Trent Williams or Corey Linsley or Joe Tooney at the top of the market, and which you know, and I don't really think necessarily that many teams should do, and this team definitely would not. And so it's an interesting game. It's like, you know, you talk about more layers. I would mention it at the beginning when you've got the coach who is seat is as hot as anybody anywhere, even in this organization that is will give you every opportunity to prove itself. But 6-25-1 is what it is. What is, you know, they're allowing him to build his roster. They're allowing him to try to create his culture. They're giving him every last chance to do it. How invested is the front office in his success this year versus prove his needing proof of concept of what he's doing and keeping Joe Burrow happy to add that element into this? What would make, and then we all start talking about what would really make Joe Burrow happy, his buddy or his protection? Like, you know, I just think there's so much nuance to it, and I think I want to end it where we started it. Just remember, when you pick a name at five, it gives you something very good that this team did not have and definitely will need going forward. But Robert, with the way that you talked through it in the piece is fantastic, and I think it gives all the elements to it that shows how much everyone I think can kind of learn from however this ends up playing itself out over time. And we will have to, you know, look back 3 years on it and see how different things could have gone.
I just want it on record that when the Bengals take Ja'Marr Chase and an offensive lineman in the second round, that's a perfectly acceptable set of decisions for me. And I am not against that. I just want that on record. So when it happens, and if it goes decently well, that's fine. I just think that, in my mind, what matters to me and how I make these decisions, it's more of a framework. I said explicitly in the piece, it's not as much about Ja'Marr Chase and Penei Sewell as it is about what they represent. And to me, it's about how hard is it to replicate and refine the skill sets of the players. And even in this draft, the drop-off between Sewell and those tackles might not be that big. Over time, that drop-off has shown to be very large, and it's been harder to find those guys. And that's really all I wanted to communicate.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. If you're going to be soft and not take a side, although you did use hashtag Team Sewell. So you really have kind of declared yourself a little bit here.
Even if it's Rashawn Slater, it doesn't matter to me. I think that's kind of the point, is that it's more about the tackle and the receiver. If you think you have them graded equally, if they think that Chase is truly a special, special guy. And I think what one executive said to Ian Rappaport this week was that he's the best wide receiver prospect since Julio Jones. If they think that's true, then take the guy. That's fine. It's hard for me to talk myself into that, considering he's an inch taller than I am. But he absolutely could be a really, really special player. And if they think that, go for it. But to me, it was more about looking at where you find these guys historically and traditionally. And I just think it's much, much harder to find a quality tackle than it is to find a quality receiver.
And I didn't even bring up maybe they should just trade back and add more picks and they can solve all the things.
I mean, that's the answer.
That is the answer. And we did the four path mock draft this morning where we went and had the trade element in there, and the seven rounds with the trades in it was far more appealing than anything else, but it's a matter of a team moving up. I will not make you discuss the trade possibilities of what could happen with number five. You've done enough. Robert, thanks a ton for your time. And again, anybody has not read the piece, I highly recommend it. It is up on the Athletic site right now. If you're a subscriber, you know. If you're not, you should subscribe, and that should be where you should do it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Robert, thanks for your time.
Thanks, man. Good to talk to you.
All right, fantastic to hear from Robert and catch up with him again. If you are not a subscriber, I highly recommend the Athletic NFL podcast that Robert does. Also, the fantastic Lindsey Jones in on that. So it's a must listen for an NFL fan as well. And he does that one with Nate Tice that they did last week, where they also dove into the same concept. You can make sure you catch that on their pod. We referenced it earlier. You know, you talk about the difference between the opinion of somebody who wants to really needs their career very focused on winning in 2021 versus a front office group that can see the long-term picture a little bit better. I wonder how that piece of this conversation is going. I really do.
I mean, I don't know if tension's the right word, but there has to be opposing sides here. It just feels, I know the coaches love Chase as a player, as a person. I don't know what side they come down. I mean, maybe they do think that Penei Sewell is their best chance to win and they can get another wide receiver later to win this year. But it just if you just look at history, there's the wide receiver is going to be the more immediate impact, and that's where you really need to have a star. We talk about it all the time. No donkeys. You don't need an all-pro tackle. I mean, it'd be great to have one for the next 8-9 years, but that's not what they need right now. They just need competent linemen that can keep Joe Burrow upright for 3 seconds, 3.5 seconds, whatever it takes to get the ball out. But yeah, it would be really interesting to be a fly on the wall at PBS and see what if it's Team Sewell versus Team Chase in the building.
I mean, at least in to some capacity, it is. Yeah. I mean, I've gotten the sense that there's some form of. I mean, how could there not be? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like as you talk through it, and I thought that was interesting as Robert and I talked through it, is every time you uncover another layer of the onion, every time you continue to talk about it more, there's another aspect of this that can be influential. It's just that's the fun of it. And I ran a Twitter poll on Friday just to like the latest dipping the toe in the water. Fans 60-40 about 59-41 technically for Team Chase. I bet he likes that. And so, you know, good for him. And I don't know if I'm surprised by that. It does seem like there's been a little bit of a turn towards him amongst the fan base. But there's so many reasons you can be on either side. And that, and I think that's the end point is there's a very great argument to be made for either path that you go down. There really is. And that should be the main thing here. And when you have that many different ways that are good and advantageous for different reasons, there should be. I would be mad if you had a front office where there weren't people on both sides of this argument, considering that, you know, you shouldn't have a bunch of the same thinkers in the room. And so I would hope that there would be people on both sides, but it's probably just a matter of, you know, what side is Duke Tobin on? Probably the end game is going to be your tiebreaker here. I mean, inevitably it's his decision, and he's going to have to pull the trigger on that. But you know, there should be a lot of indecision there.
The important thing to remember here is it's not a right versus wrong decision. I mean, so much of everything now with everything being so charged politically and everything else is where if you disagree with me, you're wrong and you're stupid, and it turns into this huge fight. This could be a decision where you could win either way. I mean, I'm sure one is going to have a little bit better career than the other, but it could end up being a thing where there are no wrong choices. There's just a good and a better choice, or a great and a better choice. I think both players are going to end up having great careers, and there's so many other variables that play in that you can't just say, well, if we would have taken this guy 5 years down the road when you're looking back on it. But it's not right versus wrong or good versus bad. They're two great players, you would assume, and it's just a matter of how it plays out once the Bengals make that call.
No doubt. Before we move on, I want to remind everybody that we have a new podcast on The Athletic that is fantastic. And for Athletic subscribers, episode 3 is out today. Episode 2 for on the iTunes, Spotify folks. It's called Shattered: Hope, Heartbreak, and the New York Knicks. It's incredible. It's a documentary style podcast on the past 20 years of the Knicks, which has just been a debacle. Chuck D is hosting. It tells all the wild, crazy stories from the past 2 decades under James Dolan. It reveals never heard stories about Dolan, the Knicks, the NBA. You get Patrick Ewing, Penny Hardaway, Nate Robinson, Jeff Van Gundy, Fizdale. There's so many people, and they're talking about what caused the end of the Knicks. You can find out what it's like to be banned from the Garden, how they didn't get LeBron, the Jeremy Lin sanity fiascos. So much in this podcast. It's just ridiculous. It's so good. I highly recommend it to anybody. New episodes of Shattered are released every Tuesday. Again, the third one is up for Athletic subscribers now. Search for Shattered: Hope, Heartbreak, and the New York Knicks, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So we'll go ahead and get ready to wrap it up. Again, I want to remind everybody, Thursday, we're going to go through the three portions of our series that are coming up this week. That's going to be specialists, which is mostly the hunt for a kicker, edge rushers and interior defensive linemen, an important one there. I guess we'll have to mention Patrick Jones, won't we?
Yes, we will.
Since he was the most popular pick right there in the fourth round. So you could, you know, you'll see his name, but there will be a lot of others and a lot of interesting elements to that side of things. You know, the one side of the defense, we've spent so much time talking about offense, rightfully so, because we think this draft is going to be very offense heavy, particularly top heavy in that way. We can't forget that they still have holes, significant ones on that defensive line that they need to improve and are still looking for pieces for the future in a deep edge draft in particular. Do not be surprised if that enters the mix. That's why the trade was so enticing. You could get a guy like Boogie Basham out of Wake Forest, potentially with that number 38 or 40, and still check off your offensive line and receiver boxes at the same time. And that is something that you really would love to do. So we'll get more into that on Thursday's episode when we dive into it there. Hope everybody enjoyed today's podcast. I want to make sure I thank and remind everybody, Dane Brugler, The Beast is out. Of course, all his mock drafts coming out, top 100, you name it. The Beast alone is worth a subscription to The Athletic on top of everything else you get. But it's just an incredible, it's a work of art, really, for draft season. And Robert Mays, if you haven't read his story on Chase and Sewell and what it says about roster building in today's NFL, that is up on the site as well. All right, thanks, then, for joining us. Hope everybody enjoyed it, and we'll be back Thursday. So we'll talk to you next time. Have a good one, everybody.